KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We were watching from the windows on all sides of my building and just watched it get closer and closer. The sky was full of ash.
How do you choose what to take with you when you're fleeing your home from a wildfire?
We'll hear one woman's evacuation story this Wednesday, January 8th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Coming up, the risks of inhaling wildfire smoke and how to protect yourself.
Also, the defining event of Jimmy Carter's presidency may be the Iran hostage crisis.
We'll talk with one man who was held at the U.S. Embassy for more than 1 year.
He saved our lives. I mean, he sacrificed his presidency and worked assiduously to make our freedom the uppermost in his mind.
Also, remembering Brenton Wood, who had a string of R&B hits in the 1960s.
When I would write songs, I'd call up ladies and ask them, what do you think about this? You know, and that kind of gave me some direction.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The death toll continues to rise as out-of-control wind-whipped wildfires are scorching the Los Angeles area. The L.A. County Sheriff's Office says the death toll from the fires has now risen to at least five, with dozens more treated for fire-related injuries. More than 100,000 people have now been ordered to evacuate. And L.A. County Sheriff Robert Luna says if people are asked to leave their homes, they should comply.
Leave. If you're under an evacuation warning, get everything ready and be ready to go, because those winds start blowing. This is so unpredictable, and we don't want anyone else to get hurt.
Flames there are being fanned by near hurricane force winds in some cases, causing some of the fires to quintuple in size in just a matter of hours. One of the blazes, the Palisades Fire, has grown to more than 16,000 acres, with more than 1,000 structures destroyed. In Washington, D.C., members of the public paid their respects to former President Jimmy Carter today, who is lying in state at the U.S. Capitol Rotunda until early Thursday. NPR's Elena Moore reports mourners are remembering Carter as a dedicated public servant.
Lines of supporters braved the cold to bid farewell to the nation's 39th president, who died on December 29th at the age of 100. Jeannie McAndrew cast her vote for Jimmy Carter when she was 24 years old.
He was a very, very smart, accomplished, kind man who cared about all of us, the truth, what is right and what is wrong. And we respect him for that.
Bruce Meredith called him a good man with strong moral values.
He gave all he had to this country. That's why I respect him so much.
Carter will be honored with a state funeral at the National Cathedral on Thursday. Elena Moore, NPR News, the Capitol.
Mexico's president is hitting back against a proposal from President-elect Donald Trump to rename the Gulf of Mexico. As NPR's Eder Peralta explains, Trump declared this week he intends to rename it the Gulf of America.
During her morning press briefing, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum showed a map from 1607, more than 100 years before the United States became a republic. The map called a huge part of North America Mexican America.
Se oye bonito, ¿no? ¿Verdad que sí?
It has a nice ring to it, she said. Sheinbaum dismissed outright changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico, a name that is internationally recognized, but she was also reminding the United States of history. The mapmakers designated the area Mexican America because the area was dominated by the Mexica people, who built a vast empire beginning in the 15th century, hundreds of years before the establishment of the first American colonies. Eder Peralta, NPR News, Mexico City.
Stocks struggled to a mixed close on Wall Street today amid conflicting economic reports. The Dow was up 106 points. The Nasdaq closed down 10 points. You're listening to NPR. Israeli military officials say the body of another hostage has been recovered in Gaza. Military has identified the man as Yosef Al-Zadani, who was recovered from an underground tunnel in southern Gaza. The military said it was examining whether a second body was that of another hostage. Defense Minister Israel Katz said earlier two hostage bodies had been recovered. The men were taken captive by Hamas on October 7th of 2023. The return of the latest body comes as Israel and Hamas continue to negotiate over a peace deal that would free the roughly 100 remaining hostages and halt fighting in Gaza. Lebanon could have a president by Tomorrow, for the first time in more than 2 years, the Middle Eastern country has gone without one because of political gridlock. NPR's Emily Fang reports that's hobbled Lebanon's recovery from an economic collapse and a recent war.
Parliamentary leaders gather on Thursday to choose Lebanon's next president after failing to reach consensus in 12 previous rounds of voting. Through an informal agreement, Lebanon's president is always Maronite Christian. Shiite Muslim officials and Hezbollah, the Iran-backed group in Lebanon, have blocked previous candidates. But Hezbollah was nearly decimated from its recent war with Israel, and its political clout is now diminished. One of the leading candidates is the current commander of Lebanon's military, who by convention is also Maronite Christian. But he lacks support from an influential Christian militia group, and Thursday's vote may end without an agreement yet again. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beirut, Lebanon.
Crude oil futures prices lost ground today. Oil fell 93 cents a barrel to $73.32 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, we knew it could happen. Here was the forecast yesterday morning on NBC4 Los Angeles.
This is a dangerous Santa Ana windstorm. The National Weather Service dubbing this as a particularly dangerous situation. It's the third time this season that they've used that strong wording. The past two times we've had big fires break out, so we have to be smart and we have to be safe.
And within hours, it did happen.
At 10:30 this morning, a brush fire was reported at 1190 North Piedra.
That's Kristen Crowley, fire chief of the Los Angeles Fire Department.
Extremely dry conditions coupled with those high winds meant that brush fire exploded. And by the time of Crowley's afternoon press conference, the fire had burned over 1,200 acres.
Tens of thousands of people were ordered to evacuate in communities between the Santa Monica Mountains and the ocean, north and west of downtown L.A. Here's Los Angeles Council Member Tracy Park.
Obviously, the scope and scale of today's fire here in the Palisades has been terrifying. We are so incredibly grateful for the swift response.
The air was choked with smoke. The sky glowed a hazy orange.
Apocalyptic scenes played out on television, like a bulldozer scraping cars off one road to make room for emergency vehicles. Panicked drivers had abandoned them as they evacuated.
It wasn't long before another fire broke out near Pasadena, north of downtown L.A. By this morning, four fires were burning, and resources were severely strained.
This is not a normal red flag alert.
That's L.A. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney at a press conference this morning.
There are not enough firefighters in L.A. County to address four separate fires of this magnitude.
Another official reported that fire hydrants in the Pacific Palisades went dry overnight. And Margaret Stewart, a public information officer with the city's fire department, told NPR this morning that the high winds make the situation especially dangerous for firefighters.
They've got debris flying. Your hose lines are ineffective because the wind just blows the water away, as well as flying embers, the smoke, the visibility. It's extremely difficult job.
She urged residents to be ready if they were under evacuation warnings.
They need to have the go bag in the vehicle, the vehicles in the driveway facing out. They need to have a plan in place, and if they can evacuate early, go now.
One of the tens of thousands of evacuees in the Los Angeles area is Adria Clokey. She lives in Pacific Palisades, a residential neighborhood on the coast where thousands of acres have already burned in the wildfires. She works for member station KCRW, and she sent us this voice memo describing her evacuation experience on Tuesday.
I was working away somewhere around 10:30 in the morning when the fire picked up. I've
lost two homes to fire in my lifetime, 1993 and 2008. So I'm deeply familiar with the process and also the anxiety around it. So as soon as there was a sign of a fire in my area, I started to go into action a little bit sooner than the rest of my neighbors. Went and put some of the most precious items directly into my car, and we were watching from the windows on all sides of my building and just watched it get closer and closer. The sky was full of ash. Almost immediately, the smoke plume was enormous overhead, and it just became unbearable. The inside of my apartment, this was maybe around noon, was completely dark. The sky outside was impenetrable brown wall of smoke. I couldn't focus on even selecting things to take at that point. I had wrapped up items like irreplaceable photos, photos that aren't digitized, and I also packed essentially what I would need for 3 days of my own life. Toiletry kit, clothes. I knew to pack shoes that you can walk through rubble with. I knew to pack a respirator, packing things that I would need if I was able to return, but if my home was destroyed. It's really hard to think of what to take in the moment. Make a list. Be prepared for this in the future. Another thing that I know from my experience is to walk slowly around your home, videoing every room, and just narrate all your possessions. Open every cabinet door, look inside drawers, talk about what you own, talk about where it came from, and just get everything you can on camera. It will make your insurance process a lot easier if you have to go down that road. With my family, we've done it twice. Doing that is obviously a harrowing experience because it clashes against your instinct to have hope that you'll be returning to your home. I'm safe. I evacuated, got into my car. As I left my condo community, there were people walking by me with their possessions in their arms, people who were walking from up the hill where they clearly had to abandon their cars, people with their pets in their arms. And the police response was incredible. So grateful for their directing traffic, because people were trying to jut out of the line of cars to escape faster, and the police presence that were on foot in respirators kept them in line because it could have been really dangerous. But I was able to crawl 2 to 5 miles an hour for 15 minutes or so to get out of the immediate plume of smoke that we were totally engulfed in at that time. Went south on PCH from Sunset. Once I got to Temescal, the traffic loosened up a bit, and my dear friend had taken a scooter from his place in Santa Monica to meet me at PCH, and I pulled over in the Jonathan Club driveway so that he could get in the car and take over the driving. And I got into the back seat and just completely fell apart at that point. And he drove us safely to my friend's condo in Marina Del Rey, and that's where I am with my cat now. We slept last night, and we have our lives, and just so grateful for that and for the support of my friends and my colleagues. And I would just say that if you have the ability to pack up and get out of wherever you are early, to do it. Just to get away. And if the fire maps are accurate, my building may have been spared. Another building in my condo community was definitely on fire, where a dear, dear friend lives as well. We're not sure about his home. Smoke damage can do quite a lot, even if the structure is still standing. I've seen that in my own experience. So I'm just grateful for my life. It's so true when they say nothing in your home is worth going back for. If you need to get out, just get out.
That's Adria Clokey, who evacuated her home Tuesday ahead of the wildfires. She's now staying with a friend who lives further down the coast in Marina Del Rey.
The singer Brenton Wood had a string of infectious soul and R&B hits in the 1960s. His music was rooted in the city of Los Angeles and its Chicano communities, and it captured hearts for decades. Wood died on January 3rd at the age of 83. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento has this appreciation.
Brenton Wood fell in love with the piano when he was 12 years old. Speaking to NPR in 2023, Wood remembered how he overheard a man from his neighborhood playing at the local rec center.
And I watched him play, and I watched him play, and when he finished, I got up and I tried the same thing he did, but my hands weren't big enough.
Wood taught himself to play piano and harmonize. More than a decade later, he had his first hit with 1967's Oogum Boogum song.
Boogum, 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 boogum now, baby, you're casting your spell on me.
The song was inspired by the miniskirt and bell-bottom fashion of the era.
And you wear that cute miniskirt with your brother's sloppy shirt. I admit it, girl, that I can dig it.
Within a few short months, Wood struck gold again. This time with the song Gimme Little Sign.
Just give me some kind of sign, girl. Oh, my baby, to show me that you're mine, girl. Oh, yeah.
That song peaked at number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100. Wood told NPR he was single when he was writing some of his most popular love songs, but he described himself as the neighborhood flirt.
When I would write songs, I'd call up ladies and ask them, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? You know, and that kind of gave me some direction.
I run after you like a fool would do, but mama didn't raise no fools and I should know.
Born Alfred Jesse Smith in Shreveport, Louisiana, Wood was one of 11 children. His family moved to California when Wood was young, and his artistic name was inspired by the Brentwood neighborhood of Los Angeles. After several of his songs charted in the mid-1960s, Wood created his own label, Prophecy Records. His music became especially popular with the lowrider communities of East LA. Last year, while wrapping up his farewell tour, Wood told NPR that the Chicanos and Cholos of his neighborhood were the backbone of his fan base.
They followed me, that supported me, long after the records came off the charts.
On Sunday, people gathered at Montebello City Park in California to celebrate Wood's life and take his music for one last cruise.
'Cause I like the way you love me. Okay.
Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Kissing me thrills me from my head to feet. And I tell myself,
you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. For more than 75 years, AU has supported freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more at au.org/NPR. From Workday, with AI at the core of its system, Workday is committed to delivering continuous innovation to prepare organizations for what's next. Workday, an enterprise platform for finance and HR rock stars. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Former President Jimmy Carter returned to Washington for the final time yesterday afternoon. Washington was never a comfortable place for the man from Plains, Georgia, and it's generally believed that Carter was a better former president than president. One reason for that perception is the Iranian hostage crisis. For the last 444 days of Carter's presidency, 52 Americans were held prisoner at the U.S. Embassy in Iran, including Barry Rosen, who was then the press attaché at the embassy, and he joins us now. Welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
You have said that if it weren't for President Carter, you wouldn't be here today. What do you mean by that?
Well, I sincerely believe that he saved our lives. I mean, he sacrificed his presidency and worked assiduously for those 444 days to make our freedom the uppermost in his mind.
Can you tell us more about that? What leads you to say that it was the most important thing to him?
Well, I remember my wife Barbara meeting with President Carter during that time, and she showed photos of my young son Alexander, who was about 3 at that time, and Ariana, my daughter, was 1. And you could see the toll it was taking on him, and that he put that photograph in his suit pocket, and I knew for sure that he looked at that.
He carried the photo of your children while you were in captivity,
right,
being held hostage.
Yes.
And do you give any credence to the criticism that if he had handled it differently, the crisis could have ended sooner, that you would not have had to have spent as many days being held hostage as you were?
After all these years, I felt that there was no other alternative. I mean, yes, there could have been military action against Iran, but I think that might have would have been taken out on us, and I think it would have been severe. We were treated terribly during the hostage crisis. I was only outside for 15 minutes only one time during the entire situation.
You were only outdoors once in 444
yes.
days for 15 yeah. minutes.
Yes. Picked up a piece of grass that was on the ground, put it in my pocket, and, you know, it brought me back to my days as a young boy with my father and going to baseball games. Those moments of freedom, those minutes were amazingly important for my survival.
Everything about the story of your captivity is extraordinary, not least of which is the events leading up to your release. President Carter personally negotiated many of the details of the release, including the unfreezing of billions in Iranian assets. But you and the other hostages were not freed until after Ronald Reagan was sworn in as president. Your plane sat on the runway. What were those final moments like?
Well, those final moments were unbelievably nerve-wracking. We were put on a bus, blindfolded, taken, I suspect, to Mehrabad Airport at that time. It took over an hour. And as I stepped off the bus, I saw in a distance a light, a person pointing toward me.
Your blindfolds were removed at this point?
Yeah, yes, they were. And then a phalanx of the student militants spat at me, and I then ran to the Air Algiers plane that was taking us to Algeria on our first leg to the trip to Wiesbaden. I couldn't believe it. I think that there's a photo of me getting on the plane. I think I was absolutely astonished.
Yeah.
And it was so amazing to just see the people that I hadn't seen for all those months. We were never all together. We were always separated. Mm. And one would never know from one day to the next if you were moved or whether a gun would be held to your head, whether you would be forced to sign some sort of statement of being a spy and a plotter.
So you arrived in Wiesbaden in what was then West Germany, and Jimmy Carter, newly a former president, was there to meet you. What do you remember about that first meeting?
It was tense. And he was with Vice President Mondale and Secretary of State Muskie, but he had the courage, I thought, to come and see us, knowing that many, many, many of us were very upset with him and couldn't understand the decisions that were made in terms of permitting the Shah into the United States. I know those were the Cold War years and all of that, but the anger was present. And
were you personally angry?
I was. I have to admit that I just couldn't understand why all that time was spent and we never really had a notion of what was going on during that entire time. The hostage takers gave us no information at all about anything. And so the isolation was so severe.
And now with more than 40 years of hindsight, do you still feel that anger, or what are your feelings?
No, I don't have that anger. You know, I have a better understanding of the situation that he faced, and that he brought us back alive, and anything could have happened during those 444 days, and I might not have seen my wife Barbara and my two children, Alexander and Ariana, and my grandchildren now. So I credit him for taking the real pains of that situation and really trying to extricate us out of, I think, the first real big hostage crisis that America faced.
Barry Rosen was one of 52 Americans held hostage in Iran from November 1979 until January 1981. Thank you for sharing some of your story with us.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
A new history book explores how the Kennedy administration cracked down on the mafia.
When JFK got elected, he appointed Bobby as his attorney general, and Bobby used all of the resources at his disposal to now destroy the mafia in America, which he considered the enemy within.
We'll speak with the author of Borgata, Clash of Titans. We'll also have coverage of the state funeral of Jimmy Carter on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, more cities are charting a path to a carbon-neutral future.
Chicago says it's now powering all its municipal buildings entirely with renewable energy.
It's a plan that gets the city to take a significant action on climate.
That story's coming up after these headlines.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. Thousands of firefighters are battling several separate wildfires, fanned by ferocious winds and smoke here in the Los Angeles area. At least five people have died. L.A. District Attorney Nathan Hoffman was out surveying the damage.
It was apocalyptic. I've lived here my whole life. I have never seen that type of devastation where literally block after block after block of houses that were there, you know, 48 hours ago aren't there anymore.
The Palisades fire is now the most destructive in Los Angeles history, burning more than 1,500 structures. Hoffman says tens of thousands of residents had to flee their homes, and he issued this warning to anyone thinking about taking advantage of the situation.
Two looters have already been arrested, and I have a message for the criminal element out there. If you think for a moment that you can take advantage of this right now or over the next weeks, months, or even years, you are wrong.
L.A. D.A. Nathan Hoffman. The Palisades fire has destroyed several historic buildings, devastating Will Rogers State Historic Park. With more on that, here's NPR's Chloe Veltman.
Judging by photographs and a California State Parks Service report, little remains of the historic ranch home where famed Western actor Will Rogers lived a century ago. State Parks officials say they were able to evacuate the horses on site, as well as some of the cultural and historical artifacts. Will Roberts, an actor known as the modern-day Will Rogers, posted his reaction to the news on Instagram.
I've done so many events at that park and the Will Rogers home. I'm devastated.
Will Rogers's widow donated the ranch to State Parks in 1944. The fire has also destroyed parts of Topanga State Park, including the historic Topanga Ranch Motel, once owned by William Randolph Hearst.
This is NPR. A new study finds that whether you're vegan, vegetarian, or omnivore, the key to a healthy gut is eating lots of plants. NPR's Maria Godoy has more on the study.
Researchers wanted to see how different diets shape the kind of bacteria that dominate the gut. So they analyzed stool samples from more than 21,000 people in the US, the UK, and Italy who were vegan, vegetarians, or omnivores. What they found is the more plant-based foods people ate, the more gut bacteria they had that are linked with better health, such as less inflammation and a stronger immune system. The good news for meat eaters is that when it comes to good bacteria, their microbiomes looked a lot like those of vegans and vegetarians, so long as they ate lots of different plant-based foods. In other words, it's the overall quality of the diet that counts. The findings appear in the journal Nature Microbiology. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Well, a new generation of design lovers are helping to revive the Art Deco style a century after its heyday. From fashion to furniture decor, the original Art Deco era embodied a spirit of freedom, creativity, and innovation. It was a style that actually defined New York more than a century ago. Now many designers are bringing back the free-flowing flapper fashion, along with its metallic accents and geometric motifs. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Well, air quality here in the Los Angeles region has plummeted because of smoke from four major wildfires. It's a health problem that people across the country have become familiar with in recent years as climate change increases the risk and intensity of wildfires. NPR's Alejandra Barunda is here to explain the health risks and how people can protect themselves. Hi, Alejandra.
Hi there.
Hi. Okay, I have been smelling the smoke all day. I actually feel lightheaded right now as we speak. Can you just spell out for us from a health perspective, how would you describe the air quality situation in LA at this moment?
Yeah, I mean, the fires are actively burning right now, so things are changing really quickly across the region. And so scientists measure air quality with something called the Air Quality Index, or AQI. And on a normal day in LA, it might be 50 or 60 or a little higher. But near the fires right now,
we have values going up to 400, which is absolutely huge.
That's Tarek Benmarnia. He's a climate and health scientist at the University of California, San Diego. And he says things are worst right near the fires, but air quality is in a dangerous range for millions of people across the LA basin.
Absolutely. Okay, so then my next question is, how does all this wildfire smoke in the air compare to, say, car pollution or other types of air pollution that we might breathe in on a typical day, especially in a major city like Los Angeles?
That is a great question. So first off, wildfires, they burn at really high temperatures, and that makes their ash more toxic than other pollution like car exhaust. And here in this case, there's also the fact that it's not just trees and plants that are burning. Lisa Miller is a wildfire smoke expert at the University of California, Davis.
The man-made materials, so things in cars, things in homes. Think of all the synthetic fibers that are present in your living room, right? In your couch, in your carpet, maybe even your clothes. All of those things can be particularly toxic.
Yeah, it's just this toxic soup. And scientists don't yet have a great handle on exactly how bad it is for long-term health, but they're quite confident that it's not good.
Not good. I mean, what are some of the lasting health effects of breathing in wildfire smoke? How much do we know?
It's another good question. Maylin Wilgus is a doctor and researcher at UCLA, and she compares the smoke exposure to smoking a lot of cigarettes. So on a day like this one, where the AQI levels are somewhere in the maybe 100 to 200 range away from the fire perimeter, she says
the exposure to fine particulate matter air pollution is similar to smoking, you know, a quarter to half a pack a day.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's not good for a healthy person, but it's even more of a problem for people with pre-existing health issues. Like, research, for example, shows that ER visits for respiratory issues like asthma or COPD, they go way up during smoke events. Sometimes they can even double. And emergency departments, they also see more issues for cardiovascular problems as well.
And what other groups of people are at particular risk right now?
So, of course, the first responders and the firefighters, they're being exposed to the worst of the smoke. But a lot of the doctors I talk with have also said, be really careful with your kids because they breathe in more air relative to their body size, so they're getting more smoke. Pregnant people should also take care, and older folks and those with pre-existing health problems.
Okay, so real quick, how should we all be protecting ourselves right now when there's all this smoke?
So the best thing to do is get out of the smoke entirely, but if you can't evacuate the area, doctors and scientists say try to stay indoors with the windows tightly shut. Limit your activity, use an air filter if you have one, and if you have to go outside, maybe use an N95 mask, like from COVID, because those are pretty good at blocking tiny particles from getting into your lungs.
That is Alejandra Barunda from NPR's Climate Desk. Thank you so much, Alejandra.
Thanks so much.
Cancer survival has made giant leaps in recent years, but after treatment, patients' lives can be fundamentally reshaped. One Common Struggle, Dating and Intimacy. We want to warn you that this story discusses sex and sexual health. Here's NPR's Yuki Noguchi on the latest in her series, Life After Diagnosis.
Just 5 years ago, Deltra James led a very different life. She was 33, married, and happily homeschooling her five daughters in Waterbury, Connecticut. Within a year, James was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. Then came divorce, going back to work, and cramming into the spare room of her mother's house with all her kids. There was much to grieve.
I was really angry that I had to start over, especially at a time where I got a diagnosis. It felt like starting over at the end, you know.
Newly single and still young, James craved escape, pleasure, and connection through dating.
Going through my divorce, going through cancer, all these different things that kind of
about telling a man named Mike Carbone.
When I told him about my diagnosis after knowing him for like 7 months, he actually felt kind of relieved because I had canceled dates enough that he questioned how much I was like into him. But the real reason was like I had just had chemo and was feeling like garbage.
The disclosure brought them closer. His compassion, she says, became its own turn-on. They're still together 3 years later. But some things are still delicate, like when Carbone dreams about a future together.
Like to check in and make sure that he understood what I'm dealing with and like the realistic odds of a future. And that was an important conversation to have because he was like, I maybe shouldn't have said that. And I was like, well, I don't want you like, talk in a way that totally writes me off.
Even with its challenges, James says, dating after cancer has given her the gift of a fuller life. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For the first time, the Netherlands has published online the names of roughly 500,000 suspected Nazi collaborators, almost 80 years after the end of World War II. As NPR's Rachel Treisman reports, the move grants access to descendants and researchers worldwide as the country continues to grapple with its role in the Holocaust.
For nearly a century, the Netherlands' largest World War II archive could only be viewed in person by certain historians. The Central Archives of the Special Jurisdiction includes 30 million documents about Holocaust victims, resistance activities, and alleged Nazi collaborators. And part of it went live last week after a law restricting public access expired on January 1st.
The fact that people can access them without having to travel all over the world is
just remarkable.
That's Amy Simon, a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University.
It's a very exciting moment for new historical discoveries.
Dutch humanities groups hope to have the entire archive digitized by 2027. For now, they have posted the names of the roughly 425,000 Dutch people suspected of collaborating with the Nazis. They were accused of trading information, harboring soldiers, and more during Nazi Germany's five-year occupation.
Collaboration, in its most expansive definition, is about participating in some way in the destruction of European Jewry.
75% of the Netherlands' Jewish population was killed in the Holocaust, the highest percentage in Western Europe. Simon says people collaborated for a variety of reasons, from self-protection to anti-Semitism.
The story of Dutch collaboration is not unknown. The most famous example, of course, is the Anne Frank family being betrayed.
But the archives could help paint an even fuller picture. Only a fraction of suspected collaborators ever appeared in court, and most have since died. Simon says the publication of their names isn't likely to have legal ramifications, but it could have personal consequences.
I can't imagine if it's my grandparent and all of a sudden a book comes out about how they were a collaborator based on these documents.
Simon hopes the distance from the Holocaust will make some of those conversations easier. It also makes them more important. Only about 245,000 Holocaust survivors were still alive as of last January. And a 2023 survey found that nearly a quarter of Dutch millennials and Gen Z think the Holocaust is a myth, or that the number of Jews killed was greatly exaggerated. Simon says Holocaust education isn't only a matter of preserving history.
As we're trying to make sense of our world today, in terms of Israel, Gaza, and anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, we have to look to the past to understand how we got here and what it all means.
The Netherlands has been reflecting on its past in other ways, too. It opened its first National Holocaust Museum last year. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. After the fall of the Assad regime in Syria, the family's properties were left abandoned. One of those was the Assad family's summer home with a private beach on the Mediterranean. It's just outside the coastal city of Latakia. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi visited the resort, which was once off-limits.
We drive through the grounds of the Assad family summer home. It's surrounded with olive groves and lush orange trees, but I also see something unexpected. And we just stopped to talk to some people, you know, dozens of people with pickup trucks and bicycles and motorcycles or collecting wood. One of them is Hanan Sari. She hauls piles of dried branches onto the back of a red pickup truck. She says her village never had the right kind of wood to burn in the stoves to keep warm. Sari says the wood here is perfect. See our land with all these olives? We could never enter it before, but now we're here, Sari says. A few minutes drive away is the gate of the summer villa. A large group of armed guards sit drinking tea and letting cars in. One of the guards escorts us up to the villa. And what a sight it is. A massive, modern, white building surrounded by gardens, cacti, palm trees, and all kinds of flowers. Inside, a breeze sweeps through the wide rooms. I'm walking through this sprawling, empty villa. It's overlooking the Mediterranean, but it's absolutely empty. You can hear my voice in some areas echoing, and that's because it has been completely looted. You can see where televisions usually were on the walls. The wires are just pulled out. There's glass all over the ground. Light fixtures are obviously been pulled out of the ceiling. And then there's black graffiti all over the walls, cursing Bashar al-Assad. Syrian friends and family are touring the home. It feels like we're visiting a museum. 25-year-old Mohammed Ismail is posing for a photo on one of the multiple balconies. He's both enthralled by the house, but also bitter. He kept his people living in poverty while he lived in a palace with a million rooms, Ismail says about the former president. Going up the stairs back to the main floor. And there's a large primary bathroom with a huge window, a bubble bath with a sunset view. The toilet, shower, and mirror are all smashed in. Outside is this beautiful area with a pizza oven and a bar. You know, you could totally tell parties may have been thrown here. There's even a row of showers just outside of where the swimming pool is. This was home to one of the most secretive dictators in the world. And now Syrians who were terrified to say anything about him are wandering around his living room. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Latakia.
In an effort to fight climate change, cities across the country are working to go green. Think solar panels, trees, electric buses. Well, the country's third largest city just took a major step. At the start of the year, Chicago began sourcing all of the electricity in its municipal buildings from 100% renewable energy. Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco of member station WBEZ and the environmental newsroom Grist has this story.
It's a cold, windy morning in downtown Chicago, and Angela Tovar crosses a busy LaSalle Street.
We have police stations, we have fire stations, we have libraries, we have buildings that provide city services.
She's the head of the city's Department of Environment, and she's listing off buildings that are or will soon be powered by renewable energy.
There's all types of buildings in terms of size and in terms of function scattered throughout the city.
And this one's City Hall.
This one's City Hall.
Stepping inside Chicago's massive City Hall, it's bustling. All around us, a flurry of busy people are rushing in and out of elevators. Now, those elevators, the lights, the Wi-Fi, the computers, everything in City Hall traces its electricity back to primarily solar energy. The same goes for over 400 municipal buildings across town.
This year, the city is transitioning to 100% renewable energy.
City officials say the move will cut Chicago's carbon footprint by approximately 290,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide each year. Using the Environmental Protection Agency's emission calculator, Tobar estimates that's the equivalent of taking 62,000 cars off the road. Of course, the city is still connected to the regional grid, which in northern Illinois relies heavily on nuclear power. Still, Chicago will effectively be paying for the renewable energy equivalent to what it uses every day. The city struck an agreement in 2022 to curb the city's carbon emissions, not just by purchasing renewable energy, but by leveraging the city's buying power to help finance new renewable energy projects.
It's the largest municipal deal that's truly bringing on new renewable energy onto the grid versus contracting for existing renewable energy.
That's Matthew Popkin with RMI, a think tank focused on decarbonization. He provided the technical assistance to help the city finalize the agreement. Here's how it works. Electric customers in Illinois get to choose exactly who they buy their electricity from. And when the customer is as big as Chicago, they have room to negotiate. The city decided it didn't want to just rely on existing solar power and wanted to help create more. So they signed a deal that helped finance what is now the largest solar farm east of the Mississippi River. It's called the Double Black Diamond Solar Project, and it spans two counties in central Illinois. It has a capacity of 593 megawatts, enough to power about 100,000 homes. And the deal dedicates about half of that power for Chicago's use over the next 5 years.
It's a plan that gets the city to take a significant action on climate and also leverages our buying power to generate new opportunities both for Chicagoans and across the state.
The company building the solar farm, Swift Current Energy, says the two downstate counties hosting the installation will see about $100 million in additional tax revenue during the operational life of the project. And back in Chicago, Swift Current and Constellation, the company that will deliver the electricity to the city, has agreed to fund local workforce programs for clean energy jobs. While most of the city's energy will be sourced from the downstate solar farm, the rest, about 30%, will be purchased through renewable energy certificates. These are credits the city can use to track their power back to renewable sources. But the hope is that eventually, that 30% will spur other smaller scale clean energy projects locally. Here's Matthew Popkin from RMI again.
Chicago is demonstrating directly how cities can lead by example, implement ambitious goals amidst evolving state and federal policy changes, and leverage their purchasing power to support a more equitable renewable energy future.
He says he hopes more cities will follow Chicago's lead, particularly as the industry braces for coming cuts in federal support for clean energy. For NPR News, I'm Juan Pablo Ramirez Franco in Chicago.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the John Templeton Foundation, funding interdisciplinary research and catalyzing conversations to inspire awe and wonder. Learn more at templeton.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
I'm a wanderer through life's highway, facing the world with a song and a smile. Old man Trouble, he keeps from my way. Happiness travels with me all the while. I'm not one of that great legion with their troubles and cares. And though I haven't much religion, here's my only prayer.